With the transfer of power in Washington, the stories the United States tells the world are changing too. Today we're joined by a public diplomacy professional who has served the United States from the corridors of Foggy Bottom to Kabul, Afghanistan. She's Catherine Brown, and she's our guest this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week, we bring you storytellers, the people who rely on stories and those who analyze stories, to shine a light on their role in shaping public dialogue and ultimately, public policies. We're joined this week by someone who has seen the power of story up close and studied it as a scholar. Catherine Brown is a PhD in communications from Columbia University, but previously served as the executive director of the United States Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy at the U.S. Department of State. Previously to that, she was a communications advisor at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, and has also worked in the White House and on Capitol Hill. She's currently an international affairs fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Brown, thank you for being with
us. Thank you for having me, Jim.
So you've worked as a professional communicator around the world, including in a war zone. You've led a rethinking of America's public diplomacy. You're a scholar and an educator. So with all of that as lead up, tell us what role do you think storytelling and narrative plays in American public life and in American foreign policy?
Well, I think it's essential, especially for American foreign policy. How we define it in the national security apparatus is as public diplomacy, and it is our efforts to engage foreign audiences through cultural means, educational, informational, meaning social media or traditional media, to really tell America's story. The essence of this is that it is really our identity as an American nation. Who are we, and how do we attract others in the rest of the world to understand America in all of its complexity and not just the one-dimensional way in which they might understand what the United States is all about?
Now, who does public diplomacy in the United States today?
Well, it's officially, so there's the official public diplomacy arm of the U.S. government. This is a dimension of the State Department. It used to be its own agency, the U.S. Information Agency. But it's a part of the State Department that has International Information Programs Bureau, a bureau dedicated to educational and cultural affairs, and one to public affairs. Currently, it's run by a foreign service officer named Bruce Wharton, who is the acting undersecretary until the Trump administration names a new undersecretary.
But it's principally a function of the Department of State?
It is, uh-huh.
So what are the platforms by which the story of America reaches people overseas in other countries? I mean, I'm assuming we're talking social media, radio, television. Talk about sort of the mechanics of it. If I'm living in, you know, Iran, for example, where am I going to find America's story?
Right. So, great question. The funding for public diplomacy is about $1 billion, which is less than 2% of the entire international affairs budget. But the people who actually maintain that overseas are foreign service officers and sometimes civil service officers in our embassies worldwide. So we don't have an embassy in Iran, so I'll come back to that in a second. But they do a mix of educational and cultural information programs. Some of it is our social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Flickr, Instagram, ones that may be popular to a particular country, they're immersed in. But it's also executing about more than 90 different educational and cultural programs to actually engage with people in person. Sometimes they'll be able to do that in a American house or American center in country, and sometimes it's about bringing people actually to the United States to have their own organic experiences. Finding America's story is supposed to be an organic experience for a lot of the foreign citizens we work with. And so that idea of discovery, of understanding America and its complexity through educational programs or listening to speakers the embassy might be bringing over to explain a certain dimension of American society, or through, you know, getting to know American culture through a rock concert or a sports program. Now with Iran, it's a little tricky because we don't have official representation there. So there's some work that's done to engage with Iranian citizens through sports. Say, if a sports team, a volleyball team, Iran, volleyball is very popular in Iran, coming to the United States, well then there's at least that engagement with American athletes, and they're able to maintain a conversation people to people that may not be able to happen so candidly government to government.
Is there any metric by which we, meaning the American people, can gauge the effectiveness or success of the story that you are sending around the world?
It's incredibly contextual and localized. And so one of the biggest complaints that Congress has had, and what my office tried to do, was how do you know this works? How do we know this is effective? And it's very similar to skepticism over U.S. development programs. Why does working on global health issues or trying to promote education abroad matter for our national security? And the USAID did a very good job in trying to change their metrics of understanding the impact of their work. There's been a push to do that at the State Department recently as well, but there isn't some long-form longitudinal study that shows you this program resulted in this kind of impact. Unless if you look at the Fulbright Exchange Program alumni or IVLP program alumni, and it's something like more than 400 thought leaders, heads of states around the world have participated in some kind of exchange program, so it's implied that there was an impact there.
Now, the U.S. intelligence community has confirmed that that Russia intervened in the U.S. election, principally through the use of a disinformation campaign, information operations and disinformation. Is there a role for public diplomacy in fighting disinformation?
There is. There definitely is. And what the State Department has been doing, along with the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is our U.S. international broadcasting arm, has been trying to stop fake news, in the former Soviet periphery in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, but also to make sure that it's been increasing its own broadcasting platforms in the region to give their facts of what is happening in the world and Russia's impact in the world and what it's been. This has been going on for some time. It's been a few years since that the State Department's been trying to combat disinformation abroad. It's just been very recent that we've realized the effect it's had here.
This is an old tactic, right? And in the early days of the Cold War, I can remember American officials saying things like, you know, that you fight the big lie with the big truth, right? Are there special themes or narratives that are particularly effective in countering that kind of disinformation?
Well, I think one of the, if you look back at the Cold War as an example in which people are drawing a lot of lessons, there was even in Cold War times with the Soviet Union, there was a much more robust public diplomacy platform that existed than we have now. There were, up until recently, something like 20 different American spaces, which are these in-country platforms for citizens to come and engage with some dimension of America, whether it be American history, society, culture, politics. But those had been systemically shut down by the Russian government. So now the American space is in the American embassy. So there's some risk involved for a Russian citizen to now engage with a dimension of America that they want to. So there's also been a curtailing of different exchange programs, like the Foreign Leaders Exchange Program for Russian youth and youth in the former Soviet periphery to come and spend a year in the United States. That program has been shut down. So to answer your question, that it used to be that in-person engagement and showing the complexity of America, the pluralism of America, and who Americans are, is seen to be effective, and that was what we did during Cold War times.
One of the big reforms in public diplomacy in the decade after the Cold War mm-hmm. was the dismantlement of the U.S. Information Agency
right.
and its incorporation into the Department of State.
Mm-hmm.
Not without problems, and it's something I know you've worked on, sort of trying to rebuild some capacity in that space. But when he testified before Congress in January, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said that he thought to fight Russia's disinformation operations in the West, that we needed he called it a USIA, a U.S. Information Agency on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Right.
And do you agree?
So I agree and I don't agree. I agree with the idea that our public diplomacy capabilities need to be increased, and financially and through personnel. I also believe that the different dimensions of our statecraft apparatus, our national security apparatus, need to work more closely with our public diplomats to make sure that public diplomacy is taken seriously. I think our adversaries do take culture and information much more seriously than the United States does. And so I think that needs to happen. What I don't agree with is moving back to the old separate agency idea. I think that in order for this to work, that our public diplomats need to be working in step with our diplomats and be closer to the policymaking decision processes.
You make a very persuasive case for the need, almost the pressing need, for public diplomacy today. Why is there resistance? I'm not going to say Congress in general, because mm-hmm. I don't know that that is necessarily a true statement, but why is there resistance in Congress and by other people? I mean, it seems like we should be pouring more money into this, hiring more people, trying to break through this cacophony of social media and fake news and news. I mean, the world is awash in stories, some real.
Making her day.
Well, it's a legitimate question. I mean, you know, I'm sitting here saying, let's go.
Well, I think that there is a natural proclivity towards believing in the need for hard power for national security. They're easy hooks in the stories we talk about U.S. role in the world, to talk about a strong military, to talk about a strong economy. But you really do need to create networks with people, not just the international institutions that create, you know, the international system that we know today, and making sure that leaders know each other better and are closer together before deciding to go to war. But our people need to know each other better as well. And so I agree that that public diplomacy is absolutely essential to national security, but a lot of people dismiss it as fluff. And because they're about relationships and they take a long time to develop, and they can take, like any relationship, they can take many different forms over many different years, they're difficult to study. And so short-term issues like the disinformation issue, like countering violent extremism issue, things that seem very tangible to hard power and are you know, requiring short-term impact, those tend to gravitate towards the top of congressmen or politicians' agendas and saying, we need to take a closer look at this. But in actuality, with the public diplomacy infrastructure that we have, and the public diplomats, especially the career foreign service officers that we have been fostering these relationships for decades. So when the moment comes that there is a crisis, we do have a well of good relationships and good intentions and goodwill to be able to draw from when it comes to a crisis. That's what public diplomacy is. It's a very, very long-term game. So it's difficult to measure, and it can be intangible.
And you don't get immediate results, which is what the public and many, many people in the country want.
That's
unfortunately,
right.
They mm-hmm. don't think it too deeply.
We're going to take a quick moment here for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. This program can be heard four times each weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's The POTUS Channel, 124. We're produced each week by the incredible professionals at Rhode Island PBS. I'm Jim Lutis from Salve Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island, alongside G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. And our guest this week is Catherine Brown, who is a scholar and practitioner of public diplomacy. Catherine, I'm wondering, we live in a world today dominated by social media, various platforms. Is the conduct of public diplomacy different today because of this new media environment, and what role does social media play in public diplomacy?
It's different and it's not. The nature of relationships and, I mean, networks have always been there, but with social media, ideas do flow faster and relationships can form digitally or virtually and not in person. So it has changed the conduct of public diplomacy. There has been some remarkable work done in the last 4 to 8 years with trailblazers like Macon Phillips, who was the White House chief digital officer for the White House and went over to the State Department 4 years ago and revitalized and really revolutionized the International Information Programs Bureau to have a digital first stance. And the example that I think is most pertinent to this is that when the former president, President Obama, decided that he wanted to reach out to African young professionals and give them more opportunity to grow professionally, he created something called the Young African Leaders Initiative. You had spaces for 500 people. They thought maybe 2,000, 3,000 people would apply, and they got 50,000 applications for 500 slots.
Wow.
So what do you do with those 49,500 people who want to engage with the United States, who are reaching out and going through the work of filling out an application, which we all know is a lie, and in a different language for most of them. So Macon had, and his colleagues at IIP, this bureau, had the idea of, well, let's create a virtual network that shows them that we do appreciate their interests and we do want to stay in touch and we do want to connect them with tools, but more importantly, we want to connect them with one another so they can discover opportunities and new ideas and become a stronger young professional network throughout the continent. So that was an example of a digital first approach really coming in to supplement a traditional public diplomacy activity.
So we have a new president. President Trump will be finishing his first month in office. Mm-hmm. Do you care to give an assessment or a prediction of where public diplomacy might go in a Trump presidency, realizing, of course, that we're only 4 weeks into it?
Right. Well, I first want to say that the apparatus that exists, the infrastructure that exists for public diplomacy is incredibly sound and ran by an extraordinary group of professionals, of our career foreign and civil service public diplomacy professionals who have served many different administrations and have maintained relationships with foreign publics despite all of it, despite different changes in American leadership. And so I think that as long as the new leadership trusts these professionals, listens to their collective wisdom of serving many different positions in the field and through their experience the last 8 years, then public diplomacy will continue to be a really effective instrument of our decision making. What concerns me is that in order for public diplomacy to be effective, public diplomacy is really just a toolkit, and they have to leverage American soft power. They have to be able to promote certain American values, promote the American story, and to do it with a certain kind of cohesion and a certain amount of, you know, authenticity. And I know that the professionals will navigate this brilliantly. They will be able to do their work. They will be able to focus on local environments in front of them, maintain relationships with people that are in the different countries where they're working. My personal concern, no longer speaking for the Commission or the State Department, is the difficulty that they will have in trying to promote stories of American inclusion. And the primary story for the last 4 to 8 years was that America is a nation of immigrants. And that was our lead story.
It's going to be a hard story to sell.
Let me pick up on that. Because you just finished a study for the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington that looking at the challenges facing public diplomacy in 2017, the series of recommendations for the Trump administration. And you're the co-author on it. You and your co-authors wrote, and I'm quoting here, "A core challenge facing public diplomacy is the gap between our stated values and our reality. When foreign citizens see incidents of racism, xenophobia, sexism, corruption, human rights abuses, or protectionism in the United States, it undermines the values of inclusiveness, tolerance, pluralism, equality, and justice that our diplomats have long worked to promote. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you went on to say, it's becoming more challenging for the United States to be a credible voice for tolerance and inclusion, given increasing division, inequality, and suspicion of the other in our own society. So, as Wayne mentioned, we're just several weeks into the Trump administration, but it would appear that they have blown through all of those recommendations, and so
in very short order. Yeah.
And so my question really is, what impact will President Trump and his policies have on the conduct of American soft power in particular?
Well, let me start by saying that when I was able to write this paper with Shannon Green and Jay Wang from the USC Center for Public Diplomacy, Shannon's at CSIS, And we did this paper by convening about 40 different public diplomacy thought leaders throughout the government, but also they're mostly former government leaders and academics. And really, what I haven't addressed is this network of private citizens who are public diplomats who just aren't working on behalf of the U.S. government, but are actively trying to build these relationships abroad through different NGOs. So just want to state that. But also, some of these challenges are not new. I'm not saying that the last 8 years or any period before where America looked like this wonderful utopia. One of the values that I'm most proud of as American is our transparency. And our news media covers that, and that news travels. And people have always, you know, been a casual visitor to America through our news media or through our popular media, and seeing violence and seeing sexism and seeing racism. So that is not new. That is a challenge that public diplomats have had to confront for a very long time, especially when it came to police brutality issues in the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, the last couple years. How do you explain that abroad when you're trying to promote these values of tolerance and pluralism while simultaneously foreign citizens are seeing, you know, what's carrying out in our news? And that's our truth. So they've had to contest that in their context. But to get to your point about Trump, I just don't know. I think it depends on what country in the world you are. I think it depends on the relationship, the bilateral relationship. I think it depends on the strength of the networks that public diplomats have created in the past with different people. But what my fear is that, you know, it might be a rough spot in public diplomacy. We may not be able to recruit as many people to come on exchange programs. I don't know, the higher education, you know, it comes about, there's hundreds of thousands of people who come to the U.S. for higher education. It injects something like, I think, $30.5 billion to the American economy. So this is essential. It's real money.
Yeah.
So we don't know. We're going to have to track kind of the lack of maybe participants. But my fear is that there's an entire national security infrastructure abroad that depends on our soft power. And I don't think people really realize this because the State Department doesn't have a constituency. A lot of people around the country know what the military does. They can, it's tangible to them. They know what troops do. They realize that they might, you know, rely on translators. And there's a lot of talk with this, the executive order, that, okay, look what this is doing to the Iraqi translators that put their lives on the line for American troops. There are many Iraqis, Libyans, Yemenis, but also many other countries who work for our embassies, who work for our aid programs, who take great risk to work for the United States because they're attracted to the idea of America, because they believe in America's story and they want to work for the United States. So our entire infrastructure abroad, you can't work in a country without a local staff. It's impossible. And these people are phenomenal. Many of them have dedicated their careers to working for the United States government. So to lose that soft power, to lose that for their idea of what America is, what gets them up every morning, to getting much objection from their family and friends of going to an embassy, personal risk to really work for the United States. That is my concern. How do we look out for the people in countries, not just in these seven countries, or anywhere where, you know, our American embassies are in these countries, but anywhere in the world? How do we maintain that idea and that story to keep people attracted to work for us.
So I want to know a little bit more about your story. You're talking about personal risk here. You spent some time in Afghanistan.
Uh-huh.
That was a personal risk. What were you doing there, and what drew you there, and what did you accomplish there?
So I originally went there because I was fascinated with the story of Afghanistan, this country that, you know, had gone through so much tragedy, yet was so stunningly beautiful. And I really felt as if, at the time I was working for the National Security Advisor in the Bush administration, and many people were going to Iraq. That was the war, that was the exciting war to go to, and this was 2003 now. And when I got the offer to go to Afghanistan, that just felt much more, I felt more connected to it in the sense that this was where 9/11 was imagined, or much of it was, and was really attracted to the idea of helping the Afghan people and using American power for good. Once I got there, I just felt really drawn to the place, and I think that's something that's really unique about Afghanistan, is that there's many Americans and Europeans and many other nationalities who are kind of like Afghanists. They have dedicated much of their post 9/11 careers to Afghanistan's development. And just seeing how quickly we were able to change or help the Afghans change their environment was really addicting. It really felt like the work was having an impact. I became most intrigued with the storytellers in Afghanistan, the Afghan journalists, the first generation of Afghans, who storytelling is a huge part of Afghan culture.
Yeah.
But here we were for the first time able to have really an independent news media and able to have, you know, independent journalism with the help of U.S. And Western aid money, but also with the help of U.S. and Western journalists who were really there to kind of be an unofficial guides to these new Afghan journalists on how to be journalists. There's no history of independent journalism there.
I have less than a minute to go, and I've got a massive question that I want to get by you, though. So the big news this week was the resignation of the president's national security advisor,
right.
General Mike Flynn. How will that kind of news and the perceived dysfunction in the White House play for international audiences? And we literally have 27 seconds.
Well, there's a lot for international audiences to take in right now about the United States and them trying to grapple with what this all means for them, and part of what is America's story now and how does that clash or fit in with who we are as a nation. So, you know, for the National Security Advisor, which to step down, I think it does show some fragmentation and some uncertainty about where America's going next.
Super. KB, we got to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us. This has been Story in the Public Square. If you'd like to learn more about our work, please follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can visit us online at pellcenter.org. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis. We hope you'll join us again next week.